Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody to Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, September 23rd, 2010. My name is Doug Kelly. Glad you could join us here with Grant Rubendunst.
Hey, welcome everybody. How you doing tonight, Doug?
I am doing fantastic. Of course, I've been looking forward to tonight's show for weeks. And,
well, that makes two of us.
Yeah, this has been a real eye-opener, I guess, in many ways for me. And it's helped me to come to arrive at some near conclusions.
Yeah, well,
how's that for definite, huh?
Yeah, well, Dr. Moody is a real pioneer in this field, you know, and I know you got to be excited about Bartow tomorrow night as I am.
And tomorrow night we're doing a presentation in Bartow, Florida at the Polk County Historical Museum, which is the old courthouse. Of course, we've been there several times and done investigations there, and I did a presentation there 4 years ago, almost to the month, Grant, and that's, of course, where you and I met for the first time, and
yeah.
Gregory,
yeah.
Of course, I'd talked to you before that, but so we're looking forward to a public
presentation.
Yeah,
it's a great place. It's a beautiful building, and Tom Muir out there has just been very cordial to us, and it's just a pleasure to be in such a historic site. It's really a beautiful, beautiful building.
So if you happen to be in the, Central Florida area, and you'd like to join us tomorrow evening at 7:30 to 8:30 for the Art and Science of Paranormal Research, we'd love to have you. And we have an investigation later on that evening, and that's pretty near filled up, but I don't know, they might be able to squeeze one or two people more in. But let's get on to our featured guest tonight. And by the way, if anybody has any questions, you can ask them in the chat room or you can give us a call at the dial-in number there on your screen. Tonight, our guest is Dr. Raymond Moody. He is a world thought leader in the area of near-death experiences and studies, having coined the phrase near-death experience and penned over 11 books, now 12, on the subject. Of course, his famous book, Life After Life, has sold 13 million copies since 1975, and it's in its 25th anniversary edition right now, and he just released his latest book, Glimpses of Eternity, which we will also be discussing. Dr. Moody, great to have you on the show tonight.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me on, because professionally this is what I love to do, is to talk about my favorite subject, which is the question of life after death. I think that's the really big question upon which everything else turns.
Yeah. So let's just briefly, and not spend too much time, but how did you get into this back in the day? Not too far back in the day, but back in the day.
Well, Doug, actually, my dad was a surgeon who had a pretty rough time of it in World War II. He was a medic and a professional military officer, and he was kind of embittered, I think, as I reflect on it, and was not much into religion. And I was from Georgia and didn't really attend any sort of religious services or anything. And at the age of 7, I became absolutely fascinated with astronomy, which is still one of my passions. And I had pretty much early in my life decided that, you know, when you die, what happens is your body disintegrates and your consciousness goes to zero.
Right.
And, but in high school, I got interested in philosophy. So I went to the University of Virginia in 1962 when I was 18, intending to be an astronomy major, but literally in the first couple of days of college at UVA, I decided I was going to be a philosophy major. And reading Plato's Republic, as a matter of fact. And Plato at that point, and is to this day one of my heroes. I mean, just this amazing individual. And so toward the end of the Republic, as a matter of fact, the end of the Republic is the story that Plato tells about a soldier named Ur, who was well known in antiquity. And he had been believed dead on the battlefield, but at his funeral, he sat up and revived and told the story, which Plato obviously took very, very seriously, about going into this other dimension of existence and having his life reviewed and all of these things, getting out of his body and so on. And the fact that Plato took this question of life after death seriously is really what convinced me of the seriousness of it. And, I mean, he has a very good argument to show that everything else kind of turns on that question. Well, anyway, then the next year I read some of the other accounts of these stories from antiquity. And, you know, it would be really amazing if we were propelled back into ancient Greece.
Hmm.
What would really surprise people would be that people discussed these near-death experiences just like they do today. I mean, people were amazed, and, you know, the same kind of debate about it. Well, anyway, then in my third year at UVA, I heard from one of my philosophy professors that there was a psychiatry professor there, Dr. George Ritchie, who had had such an experience some years before. And Dr. Ritchie, who remains to this day the finest person I ever knew in my life. And Dr. Ritchie often talked to student groups. So soon after I heard about him, I went to one of the talks that he gave on his experience, and I was just amazed. I mean, first of all, George Ritchie was just so completely strong and kind-hearted, just a very fine individual. And it was obvious that this experience was real to him. But anyway, to sort of fast forward this, I went on and I got my Ph.D. in philosophy at UVA in 1969. And then I started teaching at East Carolina University. And very soon after I started there, I started hearing these same kinds of stories related by my students. And then as I started talking about it in class, I got invited to all the civic clubs and that kind of thing in town, and I was hearing these same stories from, you know, the businessmen who were the pillars of the community would come up afterward and say they had had such an experience. So anyway, after being a philosophy professor for 3 years, I decided I wanted to go to medical school, and I, in 1972, entered medical school at the Medical College of Georgia, and of course that gave me lots of opportunity to talk to many, many people who had been to the brink of death. So since I first heard Dr. Ritchie in 1965, I've literally talked with thousands of people from all over the world, who many of whom had a cardiac arrest from which they were resuscitated, and had these amazing stories to tell. And that's how I got interested in it, just sort of gradually. It took me a long time to really come to terms with this. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that I've observed in life that very often the sort of philosophical ideas that you have as a young child, you often sort of stay with you. And it's been a very long process for me to really begin to think, oh, my goodness, you know, this this is real. A matter of fact, it's only been within the last year or so. For a long time, I just didn't know. I was agnostic on the issue, but still fascinated with the experiences. But in effect, in the last year or so, I feel like I've been boxed into a corner in the sense that it's getting increasingly difficult for me to come up with some sort of counter explanation of all the things that I've heard.
Escape clause.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And
I like that expression from your book.
Yeah, because in the last, it feels like that, because in the last year, it's like I've become to the sort of inner awareness that, whereas up to a year ago, I could honestly say to people, I just don't know. Now I feel like if I say anything other than that there really does seem to be a state of existence after death, I feel that I'm trying to run away or escape from something, or to rationalize rather than just to say what really does seem to be the case, that seems to add up to me that there is something after this
life.
Well,
let's talk about the near-death experiences, and then we'll get into the shared death. I'm sure everybody pretty much knows what they are, but let's talk about the elements. There's some commonalities, and in your book, Life After Life, you discuss, over 150, or you've done research on over 150 cases.
By the time I wrote that book in 74, I'd talked to roughly 150 people, and 50 of them in great detail. And based on that, I listed the characteristics, which incidentally have stood up very well. I mean, this has been confirmed again and again by physicians all over the world. And basically what people tell us is that at this point where their heart stops beating, they tell us that it's like they have a very dramatic change of perspective. And suddenly, instead of viewing the world through their physical eyes, they say that they seem to leave their physical bodies and they drift up and they look down, they can see their own physical body on the operating room table or whatever. They can see the doctors and nurses around trying to resuscitate them. And they say that as this progresses, it kind of dawns on them that this has something to do with death. And they say that at this point they get into a realm of experience that no matter how articulate they may be, I hear the same thing from people all over the world. They say there just are no words really adequately to describe this. But that the best they can get to it is to say that they become aware of this passageway, which they may compare to a tunnel. And they say that they go through this tunnel, and they come out on the other side into this incredibly bright light. People say that it's far brighter than anything we've ever seen while we're alive, and yet completely comfortable. They say that in this light, it's just pervaded by love, peace, joy. In that experience, they often describe just heavenly music. I mean, music that's so beautiful that they have no words or nothing to compare it to. And they may say that relatives or friends of theirs who have already passed away seem to be there almost in the role of a grieving committee. They say that in this situation, you don't really see them as physical beings like they were on the earth. For example, if you see your grandmother there in that light, and when she died, she was, had osteoporosis or whatever and was bent over, that the person you see there in that light as your grandmother is vibrantly alive. I hear people say things like, in the prime of life, and you recognize them not from a physical appearance per se, but rather because of the personality and the memories. And then as this progresses, people say that one way it's often recounted is they say that that they feel like they're in this light, and all of a sudden it's like the light grows brighter, and then everything else just disappears. And they find themselves surrounded by this full-color, three-dimensional holographic panorama. And people often say that because language is sequential, when they relate it, they have to relate it as though it were a sequence. But in the experiencing of it, it was not sequential, but rather that everything was there at once. Like one lady told me, she said, "Raymond, you could say that my experience took place in 1 second, or you could say that it took 10,000 years. And she said, "It wouldn't make a bit of difference which way you said it." But they say that in this panorama, it's often conducted by this being of complete compassion and love who's there with you, just observing these things along with you. And that, for example, if you see yourself in that panorama doing an action, you don't relive that action through the eyes you had when you did it, but rather when that action has its consequence, you are embedded in the consciousness of those with whom you have interacted, so that if you see yourself doing a harsh or mean-spirited act to somebody, then you feel the hurt that you brought about in that person's life directly. And or if you see yourself doing a kind-hearted thing to someone, then you feel the good feelings. And then, of course, obviously everybody that I've talked to anyway, at least, got back from this. And some say that they have no sense of transition. In other words, that at one moment they were in this light and the next moment they found themselves back in their physical bodies without any sense of transition. Others say that they're told they had to go back. Perhaps this being of light or one of their relatives said something like, it's not your time to go yet. You've got things left to complete, which is incidentally very frustrating to them because they're told you have to go back. You have to. There's something you have to let for you to do, but they're not told what that is, so they're just sent back. And then a third group are given a choice to either go back to the life they've been leading or to continue in the experience that they're having. And again, if you think about it, it's not surprising at all that all the ones I've talked to anyway who were given that choice, at that point they chose to come back. But what is interesting is that they almost always have the same reason, and that is that they have young children left to raise. Or they may say, for example, if they're a young person who's spent their life training for a helping profession and their idea was to, you know, growing up was to help people, then they choose to come back to complete that. And again, we see that when people come back from this, they tell us that they just have no more fear of death because their experience to them was self-certifying in the sense that it convinced them completely that what we call death is a transition into another state of existence. And
but
also,
it almost, Raymond, it also transforms. One of the things I think I find of particular interest is how it transforms their life perspective. And as you well know, a lot of the studies that have been done afterwards, some folks may have perceived themselves or had actually been couldn't have cared less about their neighbors or their friends. And then all of a sudden, after this experience, and maybe it's because they're at the precipice of taking that stand, whether they're going to stay or go. But nonetheless, their behavior changes significantly in terms of how they feel about humanity, their fellow man, that there's a mission in life. And they almost become, if they weren't philosophical about it, they certainly are afterwards, which is really interesting.
It is. And, you know, it's like one thing I've observed, Grant, is that both as a psychiatrist and just as a human being, it seems like to me that almost everybody is chasing something, you know, like some people chase power or money or fame. I've spent my whole life chasing knowledge. But whatever people were chasing, they say that when they come back from this, that they say the most important thing we can do here while we're alive is to learn how to love, because they say that's what's portrayed in this panorama. That the things that come forward are not the earthly accomplishments, but rather what this being of light is often focused on is things like acts of kindness that they did that they didn't even remember until it reappeared in this review. So
which
it's
is really,
a commitment to love.
Yeah, which is really interesting because it just kind of, for me personally, it says we're all so interconnected and we're so all unaware of our interconnectivity. And so when we do these gestures, you start a chain of events, you know, almost like in quantum physics or whatever, subatomic particles, where each chain, each touch or contact has ramifications that go on and on and on, that reverberate or, you know, the harmonics of it. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, this engineer that I talked to in England a long time ago, back in the 80s, told me, he compared this review of your life. He said, again, there's no way to really describe it in words, but he said the analogy he used was, he said, if you think of this review as like a still pond, and each action of your life is like a pebble that you chunk into that pond, he said, where it impacts on the surface, you see the ripples come out. And he said, as you watch these ripples, then when they impinge on somebody else, then secondary ripples come off of that other person,
mm-hmm.
and so on ad infinitum. So
good
that
analogy.
You... It's and you know what this is? No matter what these experiences mean, one thing I think that it does show completely is this, if you think about it, which is just amazing, and that is that life is a two-phase process. In other words, during the first phase, you go through it as the actor or the protagonist, right? And then... In the second phase, you go through the same action, but you view it from the perspective of the other people in it. And that in itself is just an amazing, you know, fact.
Raymond, we have a caller on the line who has a question and a comment. Christina in California, are you there? Hello, Christina. Are you with
Hi,
us?
Hi, yes. Can you hear
Welcome.
Me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, Christina.
Thank you. Hi, thank you very much for coming on and sharing what your experience has been like. I, at the age of 10, was drowned at a Bible camp, and it wasn't on purpose. It was another child. We were both 10, and he took it too far. And my experience was that at first I was, you know, of course, I was very panicked. I was trying to break free, but he had grabbed the top of my head and a handful of hair at the same time and held me under while standing on the last step of the ladder in the 8-foot section of the pool.
Goodness.
And what happened was I took an involuntary breath in, and all the panic and the terror that I was previously going through left me. I became very calm, and I remember floating down, and all of a sudden I had this sensation of rising up, and I thought during the confusion of everything that somehow I had hit the bottom, and I was jumping up, and you know how you do if you jump in, hit the bottom, and you kick up, and I was so happy that I had broken free and that I was almost out, and I remember seeing the outlines of the redwood trees that surrounded the pool because we were in the Santa Cruz Mountains in the state of California, and it was 1978. Just as I'm about to hit the top of the water or reach it, my hand hit the concrete below, and then I thought for a split second, how can I be in motion nearly out of the pool, but yet I can feel my hand at the same time hit the bottom. There was no more time to think about that because the next thing I knew, I was hovering above the pool and I was looking at the children who were completely unaware that I was down at the bottom. And then what happened is I was suddenly in a really misty tunnel of white light and I began screaming and crying for my mom. And at the very end of this misty tunnel, there was a really bright light, but it was really small. And I was crying and screaming for family members and my siblings, and I heard the most loving, motherly woman's voice tell me in these exact words that all those that I love will come through this light, that that is how it has always been done, and that is how it will always be. Well, I didn't believe her because I knew I don't know where I'm at, I don't know what's going on, and I started to scream even louder for my parents, and she said, look into the light, for the truth is in the light. And when I looked up at the light that was far away, suddenly I was out of that tunnel. I was in front of this amazingly beautiful light, which the only way I could describe it would be a cross between the sun and a light. It was like an orangish, whitish, bright light. But what was happening was that I was engulfed in so much unconditional love, and I was saturated with it, that what was running through my mind was, will I see the people I love ever again? And simultaneously, there were other souls in front of that light, and I was told yes. And I had such a relief. And I, at the same time, if you were to try to express the butterflies that you feel when you're first falling in love, looking into your newborn baby's eyes, a handful of joyous moments with friends and family, and the best drugs ever. I'm saying, like, you're going for surgery and they give you a drug and you're just out. If you were to, like, roll all of that up into one, it does not compare to, like, the euphoric state that you're in. And I was just saturated with it. And I said at that moment, I am staying, because I did not want to come back here. I'm 10 years old, and I had grown up in a really abusive home. And I was so happy and relieved that, hey, if I'm going to see my family, then I'll just wait for them, because I don't want to go back there. The angel told me, it is not your time. You must go back. And I was getting ready to argue with her, but she simply was not going to have it. She acted like a mother. Simply, I was then standing next to my body, and this poor man was screaming at the top of his lungs for God to help him. They had been working on me for quite some time. There wasn't a ripple in the water. All 30 swimmers were standing silently, and this was the third person. The other two people were exhausted. I remember seeing him take over for another woman lifeguard, and the next thing I know, everything went black, and I could actually feel the air move between my lips, and then I was suddenly vomiting water, and the three adults collapsed to their knees and began to sob, and I kept telling them, I'm okay. I felt fine. I felt really tired, because I really felt like I'd been on a really amazing journey. I didn't quite understand, and because I was 10, and, you know, when you're little, you're really open, and I just knew, wow, well, I am back. I'm going to make the best of it. I was happy to be back. Even though I said I wanted to stay. And I remember going into a locker room, and I could hear the echoes of the children who were allowed to resume, and laughter and sounds of water splashing kind of bounced off the walls. And I remember I just started crying and sobbing in the shower. I never spoke about it, because when I did try to speak about it, it wasn't welcomed in my home. So I learned very early on not to speak about it, but that experience forever changed the way I view myself in this world and my place in it. And I feel really connected to people, even if I don't know them, because I really feel like we're all connected. I was glowing like this white energy. It was still me. I had all my personality, my thoughts. I just simply was not in my body. And the best way I could describe it is if you were going to the grocery store and you got into your car, you reached your destination and you got out of your car, you're not your car. And I really believe my perspective is that we live in these organic bodies to experience life here. I haven't gone as far as others that I've spoken to about it, and I actually really didn't even begin to speak about it until 2 years ago. And I have some other senses that opened up that I am learning to develop, and I don't know if you've studied that as well, where the people who have had the near-death seem to begin to have remote viewing or precognitive information.
Psychic type stuff.
Yeah. Yes, and being able to pick up on what's going on with other people.
Yes. Behind, it doesn't matter behind your smile or what your profession is, I can see you for who you really are. And I sort of used that when I was a little girl to know who to talk to and who not to. And, you know, as it, like a protection. And also I feel others' pain as if it's my own. So I have a lot of compassion and empathy for people and non-judgment. I mean, I really feel like we're all here kind of like when you go off to college and we come here to learn. But, you know, it's just my perspective and my view, and I'm really grateful that I was created and, you know, just it, learning. No, I don't put people on pedestals because it's a really long way to fall. I've learned about that. So
Christina, did you have an additional question for Dr. Moody, or did you
already ask? I just wanted to ask you, have you ever yourself had a near-death experience?
No, I haven't, Christina, but I have been close to death once, but I didn't have a full-blown experience like you did, but... I am so glad you got back because I can tell you're adding a lot to this life. So thank you so much for that beautiful story.
Yeah, that was a great story.
Thanks for calling in, Christina.
Thank you so much. I hope I can continue to listen on. And
yes,
you're a very wise gentleman. I'm amazed at what your conclusions are because of the theories or just from the experiences you've heard from people. And it took me to have that experience, and for you not to have it and to come to these conclusions is a beautiful learning experience for me. But I'm cautioning everyone to please listen up to what you have to share, because I believe you really know what you're talking about, and I find you amazing. So thank you so much, and I'll be listening quietly now. Thank you.
Take
many
care.
Blessings.
Thank you.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay,
wow.
So, yeah, that was a very interesting story.
Yes, you know, it's I just have heard these constantly for 40-plus years now, and each one of them is just as fresh and delightful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like you never get tired of hearing these, because each person has their own personal imprint on it. The patterns are the same, but... each person brings something to the expression of it.
Well, let me
ask. Interesting how she said, you know, how we were just talking about before she came on with her call about how people are transformed. It's a transformative experience, an enlightening experience, and it sounds like this young lady, you know, certainly transformed her.
Absolutely.
Who she was.
Yeah.
You know,
well, you can hear it in her voice, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
She has a positive energy.
That was delightful.
So, Dr. Moody, Raymond, I have one question on the near-death experiences, and then we'll move into the shared death experiences, and it might even cover both. But as I was reading Life After Life, and even your latest book, Glimpses of Eternity, the question I had, has anybody ever referred or made reference to or talked about the concept of previous lives?
You know, generally speaking, it's very rare, Doug. I've, out of the several thousand people I have talked to, there were only three of them who, as part of their near-death experience, saw things that indicated to them that there is reincarnation. And incidentally, two of them were Southern Baptists, which I find interesting.
Yeah.
It's and I was the first years I was doing this, I was living in the Deep South, and but that was interesting in that neither of them had been exposed to that concept in their religion, and the third one was a man from Hungary who escaped after the Hungarian Revolution and settled in Zurich, where he was a very eminent architect. And this one woman I mentioned said that as she viewed this panorama of her life, she said, again, this is indescribable, but she said it was as though there were like little filaments going back to events that had taken place in previous lives. And so Although there's only that small smattering of cases that where people have brought up reincarnation, nonetheless, what a lot of people with near-death experiences have told me over the years was that they didn't feel that they got far enough into this to the point where you would be reincarnated, but nonetheless, from what they saw, they didn't see anything that directly suggested reincarnation, but nonetheless, they came back with a sympathy to that point of view. In other words, that something about the structure of the experience they had made them feel, I guess by a sort of intuition, that is a distinct possibility.
Interesting. Okay, so you explored near-death experiences considerably, obviously, for decades, and you obviously were tipped on to a different concept, which is shared death experiences. And I guess before we get into shared death experiences, let me ask a question from the chat room. It's from John Raymond. Do people's belief system come into play during the interpretation of the near-death experience?
They do to this degree, and then I've talked with people all over the world, and I know there's among the so-called skeptics, who incidentally are not even skeptics. As a professor of ancient Greek philosophy, I get very irritated to these people who call themselves skeptics when they don't even know what the word means. But nonetheless, among that crowd, without really reflecting on it or much experience, they often say, oh, these things are highly culturally variable and so on. But I just don't find that. I've traveled to Japan and China and all over South America. I've been to India, all over Eastern and Western Europe. I've had colleagues down from Africa and so on. And I hear all over the world pretty much the same story. But what people will say is that, first of all, they just don't have any words for it, but that they often say that, you know, they have to import some concepts from the religious tradition that they were raised in just to have any words at all to talk about it. And yet the descriptions are the same, and yet, you know, like a Christian may say Christ, somebody with a Jewish background might say God or an angel, and yet the description they give is the same. Now, another thing about the question reminds, you know, prompts me to say is that it really doesn't matter whether somebody had a religious belief or background at all as to whether they have such an experience. I talk with lots and lots of people who say that prior to this they just had no religious training or interest, had certainly no religious belief, and yet they have full-blown near-death experiences. And also, I've had other people who've come from just a vast array of other religions, all kinds of different religions. And what people usually say is that, by and large, people say that if they did have a religious background, what they come out of this experience with is saying that kind of the denomination doesn't count. In other words, that they see that all of the religions have elements of the truth. So it does sort of prompt people, I think, toward a more universal view. So it doesn't
same
really
thing
seem
different
to me. Yeah. Yeah,
most folks experience it, describe it as an all-loving light, very compassionate, all-loving light. And, I mean, even folks that, my understanding is, even folks that have attempted suicide still have that same experience.
That's right. That's right.
A
as non-judgmental,
a matter of fact, all-loving.
That's right. There's been series of studies done, a series of patients who came into the hospital and who had almost died as a result of a suicide attempt. And in studying these patients, they found that some of them did have near-death experiences and others did not. And of those patients who had a near-death experience, they had the same kind of near-death experience as people who came close to death from some other cause. But the difference came out in the follow-up, and that is that as the two groups of patients were followed, the patients who did not have a near-death experience when they attempted suicide continued to have a high rate of subsequent attempts to kill themselves, whereas the patients who did have a near-death experience had a zero rate of further attempts at suicide. And when interviewed, they said that it wasn't that they felt that had the suicide attempt gone through to completion that they would have ended up in some terrible hell, but rather two things. That number one, they said they learned from their experience that even when times are tough, life does have a purpose. And secondly, people say that they realized that had the suicide attempt worked, then they would have been, in effect, sort of shunted into a sidetrack, and that what would have happened was that they would have had to see directly the hurt and the sadness that their suicide attempt had brought about in the lives of their loved ones. So these experiences seem to be pretty much an absolute deterrent to any further attempts at suicide.
Here's another question from the chat room. This is from Sharon. Have there been any stories of people going back as spirits to their loved ones, as in a typical haunting, before they came back? So did they go anywhere and do anything? Or
oh, yes. I've heard quite a number of those over the years. People say that while they were out of their body, they, you know, when nobody could see or hear them in the hospital, which was, people often say that although they can see and understand perfectly what the doctors and nurses are doing, that when they try to communicate, nobody can see or hear them. So one thing you sometimes hear is that they say they go into some other part of the hospital to try to, you know, get the attention of one of their relatives, or even go to, you know, back home or something, to their house, to try to see if one of their relatives at home can see them. So, yeah, there is this. Sometimes they sort of go at a distance and then eventually come back to their body during the when they're brought back into their body.
Raymond, do you think that one of the things that I thought was interesting is some of the research that was done by Dr. Pim van Lommel over in the Netherlands?
Yes.
And here's the thing that I wonder about. That I think, if I remember correctly, they said that the folks who had the core, where they talk about the highest level of the experience, were those
yes.
more inclined to have a near-death experience, and also that they suspect that they were the least likely to, in some cases, to disclose that. And then shortly thereafter, I don't know what the percentages were, I don't have all the things in front of me, but shortly those people passed away. You know, their situation was either their heart attack. But I just thought that was really interesting, and it made me wonder whether, you know, folks, whether they don't feel that it's socially acceptable. And I think it makes me wonder, you know, as to how many of these things, I think that's probably underreported.
That's exactly what I think, Grant, because what I have noticed, for example, over the years is that, well, let me give you a specific example. I knew a wonderful cardiac person, like an internal medicine doctor, heart specialist in Hamburg, Germany, and also a cardiologist in Denver by the name of Fred Schoonmaker. And both of these men had been in practice for a long time, and they were also what we call oral personality people, that is people whose primary emphasis is serving others. They're often kind of roundish in configuration, for example, because they enjoy eating and this sort of thing, and it's a certain kind of personality type. You could think of probably friends of yours who fit that pattern. And they, this Dr. Becker, I think his name was, and Dr. Schoonmaker, both said to me that they felt that the percentage was somewhere around 60% to 70%, but that was based on their interviewing their own patients. Fred, by the time I talked to him, had resuscitated over 1,600 patients.
Wow.
And I think there's also a factor in terms of how the information is gathered. I mean, it's one thing, for example, if the physician comes and comfortably sits beside your bed and talks with you, well, you got really close, you know, what are your recollections? You might be more likely to talk about it, see, under those circumstances, rather than if somebody came in and gave you a questionnaire, for example. You might wonder, well, why are they doing this questionnaire or whatever? So they probably are, my guess is, underreported. And at the same time, you see, when you're doing a study like Pim did, then you have to have sort of more exact controls, and you know, that may require a questionnaire or whatever just to be systematic. Because a personal interview would introduce all sorts of complications. So I believe that Pim's study said it was about 18% to 20%. And so there is a real, you know, there's a real difficulty in ascertaining exactly what percentage of people who undergo a cardiac arrest remember something like this. But I tend to side with you on that one. I think that they probably are tend to be underreported because, you know, it's a very personal thing, and people often report to me that they didn't talk about it because they were afraid that other people would judge them. Well, for example, Christina said that she didn't talk about it at home because she definitely sensed that it wouldn't be received well in her family and so on. And this is, I suspect with you that it's probably a greater percentage than the studies show.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we have a couple, three questions that I'd like to knock out real quick in the chat room, and then we're going to take a 3 or 4 minute quick break. And then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about shared death experiences. And we also have somebody holding on the line that we'll take after the break. Does that sound okay with y'all?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Raymond, back to the question on if people go visit their homes or elsewhere, the follow-up question is, do these people indicate any characteristics of why this happens rather than going down the tunnel?
I can't think of anything in particular. One thing that just comes to the surface in my mind is that very often these are situations where the cardiac arrest happened suddenly and unpredictably. I mean, the person, there was no expectation at all that they would be suddenly, you know, propelled into a cardiac arrest. So in this confusion, they feel like they try to get to their relatives.
Okay. Here's another question from Rose. How do you feel about meditation and hypnosis? Could it provide communication or a similar experience as a near-death experience?
I don't think so. I think, you know, hypnosis is greatly overrated in the sense that people tend to think it's something magical.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is a very helpful therapeutic modality, but 90% of the people you hypnotize for the first time will say, oh, I've been in that state before.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
it's a natural state of relaxation and deep relaxation and concentration. I think in terms of the deep, no, I think
okay.
not. A hypnotic experience is something of a different order of magnitude. I think people say, for example, that these near-death experiences are hyper-real. That is, that far from being dreamlike, that they make this life we're in now seem dreamlike by comparison. In other words, it's more real than ordinary physical reality.
Okay.
And, you know, that brings up, just to add something here, at a time when the body, the physical body, is in absolute crisis, and chemically all your body chemistries have to be, I'm not a medical doctor like yourself, Raymond, but I would assume that instead of having any clarity or lucidity from a physiological standpoint, at that point it'd be just the opposite.
That's exactly what happens, and it's like, I mean, if you've, I mean, when you're sitting there with somebody who's in end-stage emphysema or something, they're very confused. Whereas people with these near-death experiences, it's, as I said, it's more real than real, and you know, complete lucidity. I think that these physiological explanations you hear about, that it's the, you know, the oxygen is diminished, so therefore the brain puts up this hallucinatory show that people interpret to be the as the near-death experience. Really, I think that's pretty much out now with these empathic or shared death experiences. I mean, every single element that we use to say that that we associate with a near-death experience also occurs to bystanders. I mean, people who, medical personnel, for example, who are dealing with a patient who's dying, or relatives and loved ones of a dying person assembled around the bedside of the dying, that as that person passes away, the bystanders themselves can have these same kinds of things, leaving their body, or seeing the patient spirit leave the body, or seeing this light, seeing the relatives or friends of the deceased come and to sort of take the person away, hearing this beautiful music.
And we're going to get into that just after the break. Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. Let's one more question. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and get right into that. This question from Rob: is there a ratio of society that has these experiences, and is there any type of mental similarity among them?
In other words, is there a ratio of society? I mean, I'm supposing that to mean like an estimate of how many. And absolutely. The Gallup survey that was done, I think, in 1979 said that at that time there were about 8 million Americans. But correcting for you know, the current population, that would be probably, you know, 15 or so million Americans. And that coincides very well with the, you know, my estimate that I had when I was, I used to just notice gradually when I was lecturing to these civic clubs and so on, that if there were 30 people in the room, then, you know, it was highly likely that at least one of them there would have had such an experience. So this is a very, very common experience, and anybody essentially can verify this for themselves if they just open up and sympathetically ask relatives and friends and so on who've been close to death. You can convey to people that you're willing to listen sympathetically, anybody can find cases of this among their own acquaintances.
Any type of mental similarity among the people that do have these experiences?
No. I mean, there have been various attempts, but it's just, I've known every kind of person from the, you know, these severe obsessive compulsive business people, you know, the kind of people who make lists all the time and live by the clock, have had these experiences, and then on the other hand, people, I mean, just every kind of personality type that you can think of. So I don't think that there's any pre-existing characteristic that helps us understand why some do and some don't.
All right. We have been talking about near-death experiences with Dr. Raymond Moody. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to get into a related topic, very interesting, shared death experiences, and we'll also take your questions and calls then. So hang on. We'll be back in about 4 minutes.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
Okay, and we are back. We are talking with Dr. Raymond Moody, who is obviously the expert in near-death experiences. Welcome back, Raymond.
Thank you guys so much for having me. This was really fun.
Absolute pleasure.
Okay, so as promised, we're going to start talking about shared death experiences, which we've been trying to do for a while. Raymond, what's up with shared death experiences? How are they different than near-death experiences?
Well, shared death experiences are identically the same phenomenon. Like all of the elements that we've talked about occur also in shared death experiences, but the difference is that they occur not to somebody who almost dies and returns, but rather they occur to someone who is present at the death of somebody who actually does go ahead and die. And I first became aware of these, Doug, in 1972 during my first year at medical school. One of my own professors of medicine, a very nice lady, told me this experience that happened to her when she had been trying to resuscitate her own mother. And she said as her mother died, she herself, this physician, felt herself leave her own physical body. And she said, to use her exact words, she said, I was trying to get my bearings. And she said, as she goes, look, what's this going on? You know, she could see her own physical body down below trying to resuscitate her mother and saw her mother's now deceased body in the bed. And she said then she became aware of her mother there beside her, again to use her exact words, now in spirit form. And she sort of conveyed her goodbyes to her mother, and she saw her mother recede into this light, and she saw her mother's deceased friends and relatives sort of coming out of that light to this reunion. And then she saw them all sort of recede back into this light, and this passageway or tunnel-like thing closed down, and she said when it did, it closed in the form of a spiral like a camera lens does. And then she came back, and there she was standing beside her mother's now deceased body back in her own body. And that was the first one of these I heard. And for some years thereafter, I heard these almost exclusively from doctors and nurses who were present there. A very common thing, for example, was that doctors would tell me that as a patient died, they saw sometimes like a transparent replica of the deceased person just sort of rise up and move away from the body, or sometimes like a golden grayish light which had a structure to it would seem to rise up and to go away through the ceiling or whatever, or doctors and nurses telling me that during the dying process they were aware of the spirits of other people who seemed to be the deceased relatives or friends of the person who was dying, or these effects of light and so on. And this For people who are young, this next thing is going to just sound so horrible, really. But sadly, when I started medical school in 1972, our standard practice was that when we could see that the patient was dying, the doctors and nurses would come in, and we would sort of escort the family out with the good intention that, you know, thinking, well, this would be too overwhelming for the patient's family and so on. So the doctors and nurses were typically there at the end. Whereas in the intervening years, what's happened is now the hospital practice is almost totally reversed, and now the doctors and nurses encourage the family to be there till the end. And so along with that change that I've seen over the decades that I've been in medicine, I've also seen a change in pattern of these shared death experiences, where now I'm hearing them predominantly from loved ones and relatives, friends and all, who were there at the bedside of a friend or loved one who died. And all of these things, including the people say that they themselves sometimes say that as the loved one died, they themselves got out of their body and seemed to accompany the dying loved one partway toward this light, or they may see the spirit of the person who dies seem to rise up and leave the body. People talk about the light in the room changing and the room being flooded with this light, this very comforting light. People talk about seeing the spirits of the relatives and friends of the dying come to sort of take them away. I've heard accounts of music. They say the room fills with this beautiful, unearthly music. And most incredibly, I have lots of reports, actually. I mean, not large in the percentage-wise. I mean, I think probably percentage-wise this is a somewhat rare occurrence, but it happens enough that any diligent investigator can find cases in which somebody at the bedside of the dying will actually empathically co-live this panoramic life review of the person who dies. And this to me is just something really startling. I was actually planning to write on this in 1994. And I was gathering up my case material, and I had a lot of cases at that point. And I was actually out west with a group of people trying to figure out some systematic way of investigating these shared death experiences. But that it happened to be Mother's Day of 1994. And after our meeting, I went to the local shopping mall and used an antique object, which probably the young people listening won't have any idea what it was, but it was called a payphone. And I went to the payphone and I called my mom to wish her a happy Mother's Day. And to make a long story short, she told me that she said, "I'm feeling great," but the previous day she had developed this rash, and my brothers and sisters had taken her to the doctor to get it checked out, and he didn't think it was anything significant, but he gave her an appointment to see another doctor the following Monday, which was the day after I talked with her. But when she went to see that doctor, he diagnosed her with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and told her that she had 2 days to 2 weeks to live. And indeed, 2 weeks later to the day, she did die. And my wife and I had been there with her the whole time through these 2 weeks. And as my mother died, I myself and my wife had this experience, and also my sister there, sensed the presence of my father, who had passed away 18 months before, and my brother-in-law. And so really, I think, you know, when you have something like that happen to you, and I'm sort of driven by curiosity, and in a funny sort of way, that satisfied my curiosity, but also deepened my interest in this. So to make a long story short, I put this all together in a book called Glimpses of Eternity, which has just been published by Guidepost. You can find it through Amazon.com, or you can get it at glimpsesofeternity.com. And this is a book in which I talk about my research with this phenomenon, which to me is just utterly amazing because, as I said, it just sort of knocks the props out from under that explanation in terms of the brain damage. I mean, if it's, as I said, as a sort of surface plausibility to say that, well, if a person has a near-death experience where their heart stops beating, then, you know, perhaps the diminished oxygen flow to the brain somehow creates a hallucinatory phenomenon, which is reported as the near-death experience. But when the same phenomenon identically happens to the bystanders, and they're not ill or injured, you know, there's nothing wrong with their brains, then we're really, I think, just sort of propelled here into a wholly different kind of debate. And I think in a way that the shared death experience and what we call the near-death experience is really the same phenomenon. So,
I have a question on that, too. But I'd like to, before I ask my question, I would like to take a call from Donna from Illinois. You wanted to comment about her mother's near-death experience. Donna, welcome to the program.
Hi, Donna. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Donna.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much for welcoming me. My mom, when she was 19, she was giving birth to my oldest sister, and she had an inverted uterus. And at that time, they had brought my dad and my grandma into the operating room. And my mom said that she was walking down a tunnel towards a beautiful, warm light, and she just wanted so bad to get to that light. And she said that she heard my grandma and my dad calling her, and when she turned her head, she came right back. And she says now she'll be 80 next year, and she said, my dream is that I'm going to be able to see that light now. Nothing frightens me.
That's good.
Yes, that's exactly what I hear from people, that after this they just have no more fear of death.
Yeah, she said nothing frightens her at all.
So that's going to reassure you too, huh, Donna?
It will reassure me. I have this, my sister passed away 2 years ago. And
sorry.
Thank you. I have, my brother passed away like 30 years ago, and he comes to me in my dreams and tells me when I'm going to lose someone. He'll come to me and tell me, you know, like he told me that, you know, Sheila will be with him on the 10th.
And so what happened?
Across, yeah. He was dancing in the kitchen in my dream, and he said, she's with me, number 10. And then when I woke up, I said to my husband, oh, gosh, I'm going to lose my sister on the 10th. And this was only like the 1st of February. And then I had a dream about the neighbor across the street that the sister came over and said, in my dream, she said, Jimmy passed away. It's December 12th, and Jimmy passed away. And the wife was, in real life, was going to go out of town, and I had told her, no, stay. I didn't want to say why. I just said, please stay. And then he did pass away on the 12th, and then that night that he passed away, I dreamt that he was standing in front of his house and just looking up and down, like back and forth in front of the house, and then he just walked away.
Hmm.
So I don't
know.
Yes, I've heard these similar stories from many people, Donna, that as a matter of fact, our assistant of 17 years, who's one of the most grounded people I've ever known in my life, she just, from her life history, is just like a person of enormous strength and directness and honesty. has had this since we've known her. Several times it's happened that she's had these extraordinary intuitions that someone was about to die when there was no external markers at all, and yet she, you know, she was accurate. And I mean, I've seen this happen not just with our assistant, but with I knew a nurse once who had that sort of remarkable ability, and I certainly can't explain it. One thing that does occur to me is that people with these near-death experiences and with the shared death experiences will tell you that in that state of existence, that time as you and I appreciate it just does not exist, that everything is there at once, in effect, that you can say.
Well, Donna, thanks for calling in and sharing your story. We'll leave you on the line. You can listen if you'd like.
Thanks so
very
much.
I'll listen on the computer. Thank you very much.
Terrific.
Bye-bye. Now, Raymond, this talk right now kind of brings us to this question. And, you know, we're talking about the skeptics. You know, they're saying that near-death experiences, lack of oxygen to the brain, other physiological issues that might occur during death to cause these kind of experiences, and yet we have the shared death experiences. And just as Donna had talked about, she obviously is getting foreknowledge of events, and fairly accurately, it sounds like. And of course, many other people have this psychic ability, you know, as it were. Here's the question: in your experiences with any of these folks. And this is a question that from Doug. I mean, this is something I've been pondering and contemplating as I've read your books. Okay, so we've got the shared death experience. We've got the loved ones who are there, healthy loved ones who share in this near-death or this death experience, I should say. And they often will go through the life review. They'll walk down the path or the tunnel to a certain point and then not allowed to go any further and on and on. Could this be attributable to some kind of an Akashic record or cosmic library where they are getting this information from there rather than experiencing it? You know what I mean?
Doug,
like a psychic thing.
I just don't know. I don't know. One thing I think about this whole thing, to put it into context, is that number one, the issue pretty soon is going to be forced. I mean, in the sense that society has fallen into this sort of comfortable way of debating this, and it's cast as between the believers and the so-called skeptics.
Right.
And I could give you a little brief summary of why these people are not skeptics, and that is that, incidentally, over many years I've been confronted with these so-called skeptics, and one question I've often asked them is, well, then, can you tell me who Pyrrho was? And they say, huh? You know? And believe me, that if somebody tells you they're a skeptic and they don't know who Pyrrho was, they don't know what they're talking about. But Pyrrho was the ancient Greek philosopher who followed Aristotle. He was a Hellenistic philosopher. And Aristotle, as you know, codified the logic that you and I are using as we're having this conversation. It's, it's the standard Western logic.
Mm-hmm.
And Pyrrho was the founder of the skeptical movement. And the essence of being a skeptic is that it's really a spiritual and intellectual practice of not drawing conclusions. That's what it means. And it's the practice, because they found that they knew fully well how to draw conclusions, because Aristotle, in effect, taught us procedures for drawing conclusions. But the skeptical question was, well, then what if we don't draw the conclusion? And they even had manuals to tell you how to avoid drawing conclusions. You know, like, don't draw the conclusion. There's a table there. You know, it might be a cardboard cutout. It might be a holographic projection. It might be an illusion or whatever. And they found that by assiduously following this method, two things would happen. Number one, they would have an experience of mind expansion. And number two, if you think of it geometrically, if everybody else is rushing in the same direction to get to the conclusion, but you are withholding a conclusion, then what happens is that it opens up, in effect, your peripheral vision. And then you can see side pathways of inquiry that everybody else had missed because they were trying to get to the conclusion. Now, knowing that, play back in your mind what you hear from these so-called skeptics. Oh, I'm a skeptic about these near-death experiences. I think it's just the chemistry of the brain. Well, if you unpack what a person like that is saying, it's that I'm a person who doesn't draw conclusions, and my conclusion is such and such, right? So that's a self-contradiction. And these people who falsely label themselves as skeptics are by that very act showing that they are ignoramuses. I mean, that's just
anything
a
but.
Fact.
Yeah.
Now, what we really need in this field is some real skeptics. I mean, in other words, people who do withhold a conclusion, because we are dealing here with something that is very, very important.
Yes.
And I think that what we really have to do is that we have to face up to the fact that the logic we use in trying to think about these things is not adequate to the purpose, because Aristotelian logic is predicated, among other principles, on the principle of non-contradiction. Like ordinary logic doesn't allow in a self-contradiction. And yet, if you think about it, the sentence, "There is life after death," is a self-contradiction. If you look it up in the dictionary, you know, death just means the final irreversible cessation of life, and hence it's self-contradictory,
right?
Say there's an afterlife. Well, this has always been the logical problem. Now, what I can tell you guys with complete confidence, and I could prove this to you, but it would take me 2 days to do. I mean, I have to take people through a procedure, and it's not really geared to the paranormal or life after death or anything like that. It's just like an alternate code of logic that I've developed, actually beginning in 1963. It was part of my doctoral dissertation. It's something I taught to logic students and psychology students and philosophy students over many decades now. And basically, what we are on the verge of now is entirely new ways of rational investigation of this question of life after death. And I am confidently predicting that within the, if you look 5 years down the road, then the status of debate and inquiry into the afterlife question 5 years from now, I think is going to look very, very different. I do feel that we are really on the cusp of truly amazing new developments.
Well, you know, I think also too, Raymond and Doug, that this research is caused us not only it is causing us to redefine what death is.
Exactly. For example, I'm sure that you guys have heard of the case of Pam Reynolds, for example,
a woman
who had a near-death experience when her brain was. Her head was completely drained of blood, and her body was made hypothermic, I think, to 60 degrees, and her heart was stopped, and all the blood was drained from her head to repair an aneurysm, and yet she and was in this state for a long time. They had EEG, and you know there was no electrical activity in her brain, and yet she had a very dramatic near-death experience. Now, it's kind of like what you were saying, Grant. I mean, what do we call that? It's some people are beginning to say that, you know, there's a third state, and that's what they call it, the third state. In these cases of cardiac standstill where they do the brain surgery, what do you say about a person like that for that hour where they had no brain activity? Their body was cold, and yet...
Well, especially when they can identify surgical instruments
and
conversations that actually took place in the operating theater. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and you know, there's an old saying. That's right. I love that old saying, science proceeds one funeral at a time. Or and it really does. You know, it's like, I think that it's for a new generation of investigators are going to, because I think there's a certain kind of mentality. For some reason, there are just some people who are terrified of this. I mean, they just don't want to face it. And yet, with the improvement of resuscitation technology and all the baby boomers now are losing their parents, I mean, it's just bringing about a tidal wave of these shared death experiences. So how are we going to integrate that? I think it's a very, very exciting time to be in this field of research.
Well, you know what, too, Raymond? I think I first became interested in this in the 1980s, and I think that there's been a remarkable turnaround in how mainstream medicine looks at this.
And we were
so out in the lunatic fringe in the 70s, and then researchers like yourself, real pioneers.
I know. I really have to keep running fast to stay in the lunatic fringe. You know, I mean, that's where I want to be. You know,
I've been a proud member for a long time, I must admit. Programs on National Geographic's on near-death experience,
I didn't know
Dr. Sam Parnia is getting funded here, or I just saw a video that he did not so long ago, and he's more interested in cardiac arrest. He wasn't interested in near-death experiences, and I just think that mainstream medicine is coming to embrace it. And maybe, you know what, you said something, Raymond, I thought was really important. You know, 100 years ago, when a person died, his family gathered around him, and they did the watch, and they took care of him, and they were all part of that family, that tapestry. And I think, you know what, maybe through the researching this, maybe we'll come back to that spot that we were. Because
I think we're absolutely already doing it. And I agree, Grant. I mean, there's a popular myth I've heard again and again, poor Dr. Moody, you know, he was persecuted by the medical community, but that's just false. As a matter of fact, when I went to medical school at the Medical College of Georgia in 1972, I had already been investigating this for really 10 years, beginning with Plato. Uh-huh. And so I was already known among my friends for this interest. And so my friends who were ahead of me in medical school had already circulated word among the faculty that this student who was coming in September, Raymond Moody, had been investigating these things. And this was 1972. And within the first couple of weeks I was at the medical school, 8 professors went out of their way to call me or come to my house or invite me to their house or office and began the same way. It's like, Dr. Moody, I'm so happy you're investigating this, because about half of them had heard it from their own patients and took it seriously, and the other half had the experience themselves. So I think that it's really kind of a, you hear these people complaining all the time, oh, doctors don't take this seriously. And no doubt there are plenty of doctors who don't take it seriously. But there are a lot of doctors who do take it seriously, too. And I think they tend to be the ones who are more humanistic medical people who actually take time to listen to their patients. And
all right, we are getting low on time, unfortunately. I could go on talking about this for a while yet. One last really quick question from the chat room, just a real quick answer. Has anyone come back with memories of seeing any animal spirits from these near death?
Yes, I've heard a few of those with near-death experiences. However, they seem to be rather rare. But getting back to something that Grant says, I think that we might be in an under-reporting situation here, in the sense that it occurs to me that perhaps people might be more embarrassed to say something that they, like they saw their pet or whatever. But nonetheless, it does, you know, I have definitely heard a few cases where people say they saw their dogs or whatever.
I encourage our audience, live audience, and those who are listening to the archive, to read at least both of your two better-known books, and for me, that's Life After Life, talking about near-death experiences, and Glimpses of Eternity, talking about shared death experiences. I know you have others out there, too. There is a link on the show page there for Amazon, too. And also visit Dr. Moody's website, lifeafterlife.com, is it? Dr.
Yes.
Moody? Okay. And this, to me, this topic, as you've already brought out in your books, will do more to prove life after death than almost anything else that I can think of. And for me, it's been a pivotal thing, and I've appreciated both the books. I've really appreciated having you on the show. It's been outstanding. Thank you so much for coming.
Likewise, Doug. Thank you both so much. And you too, John. I just really, it's been delightful to be with you guys. And I would love to do this again. Let's do it.
Oh, we'd love to have you back.
We will get Sharon on that right away.
Well, yeah,
yeah, don't offer like that. We're going to take care of that one. But we'll have Sharon contact you. And I, speaking of John, we do thank John for screening the calls tonight. We thank our audience for tuning in, and as well as
all of our callers tonight too. Thank you so very much.
Yeah.
And we'd like to encourage everybody to join us on Sunday night for Informal Paranormal at 10 p.m. Eastern. John and Rossi and Mike Jones will host the show, and John is going to be doing an investigation at a Native American village near Buffalo Gap, Virginia on Saturday night, so they're going to be talking about that, the multiple locations involved in that. Next week we have, I believe it's Steve Parsons coming back along with Ann Winsper, talking about time slips, the psychology of EVP, and ghost gadgets. So please join us next week, next Thursday, 9 p.m. for Paranexus Universe. Again, Dr. Moody, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. This has been so much fun. Thank you very much.
And everyone else, we hope you have a great weekend. Talk to you next week. Good night.
Good night, everybody.